Well, I don't want to waste you guys' time, and it might be a quicker meeting if it's just the three of us, but why don't we go ahead and start the conversation?
Okay.
And maybe we can leave the appointment of committee chair to the next meeting if we since we probably want a bigger attendance for that conversation.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Not me.
Yeah, me too. Not me.
All right. We'll table that one. So then the first item after that is the discussion of the 2012-2013 biennial budget. And if you all got my email from yesterday that I sent out that basically trying to make a distinction there between what currently for fiscal year 2012 is the budgeted total and then the unbudgeted total, meaning the total that staff would like recommendations from the council on in terms of what actionable steps can we take using that funding amount to further the purpose and the goals of the council. So in terms of that document, as I stated at the December 5th meeting, that unbudgeted total is roughly $100,000 for this year, and I think Elizabeth and I are assuming that it would be about $100,000 for fiscal year 2013 as well. And Elizabeth just joined us.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Paige and Jean are on the phone.
Good afternoon, both Paige and Jean.
Good afternoon.
So I guess given that you have the numbers to look at, I also wanted to talk about possible recommendations we heard at the December 5th meeting, and then other budget recommendations that staff has brainstormed since then. So just starting with the December 5th meeting, there were two recommendations that staff had brainstormed that I mentioned at that meeting. The first one was concerning the fact that we had a rural and farm worker housing study that was is pretty much at its completion at this point. And one of the things that our contractor, our outside contractor who did that study did was do an inventory of all affordable housing in rural areas of the state, which I think is a tremendous amount of data that we can use. And so one of the recommendations was perhaps to complete the inventory to be hiring an outside contractor to be able to complete that inventory by adding the urban areas. And so that was in an effort to fulfill the statutory obligation that we are supposed to track and monitor service-enriched housing across the state. And I think that if we had a full inventory of not only what the Texas Department of Housing has funded, but also what is put on the ground by other sources of federal funding, such as USDA or other HUD funding sources, what's put on the ground for public housing, and all the other sources that are available. So that's one possible use of funding.
But that would be an inventory, you would say, of service-enriched housing.
I think, yeah, well, I think what we need to do is we probably need to do as much of a complete comprehensive inventory of affordable housing as we could, and then work from there as to, you know, what the subset of service-enriched is.
Okay. I couldn't support that, quite frankly, the money from this committee, because, I mean, I could, and I thought we already had sort of inventoried whatever we could find as far as service-enriched housing goes, but not all affordable housing, and only because my greatest concern here is I think our statutory charge is to create more, and I think we're now, you know, a whole other session into this, and I don't know that we can show any effort to really create, and I don't know how we get to move towards that, and of course I see it a lot more in policies where tax credit money is actually, you know, the department takes some bold steps and, you know, actually sets aside tax credits. You know, to me, it's build it and they will come. Put money aside and they will come to try to promote the development of service-enriched housing. I think our statutory requirements are pretty clear on we're supposed to be increasing or promoting or developing service-enriched housing, and I'm getting real worried that we don't seem to be going that way.
Right. So the statute itself says to promote the creation of service-enriched housing through increased coordination of housing and health services. And so that's, you know, it is a very broad goal there. To promote the creation of it is how it's framed, and we can take that as the council wants to take it. So if we want to take it steps toward
truly
creating it, towards trying to increase the coordination of partners that would be required to, be put together to make that happen. I understand your point, Jean. And in terms of, obviously, there's recommendations that are policy recommendations towards the department, and what you're saying, which is, internally with the existing sources of capital financing, making recommendations on those sources, and that we can do, of course. In terms of what we want to use the unbudgeted amount of our own budget towards, we can either, that's all a separate pot of money.
Now, maybe this is paraphrasing. I'm looking at your all's draft Texas Low-Income Housing Plan, and the way the Housing and Health Services Coordination Council is described, it says the council's purpose is to increase the amount of service-enriched housing for seniors and people with disabilities. And, maybe y'all are paraphrasing it that way from the law, but when I start to read those things in your plan, it's like we better get there. We better start increasing the amount of service-enriched housing and being able to show that we're increasing the amount of service-enriched housing, and it is, in your all shop and you all the housing provider. I'm just, I'm looking for some bold things to happen.
Jim, you're looking at what, the 2012 draft slip?
Yeah.
I just want to make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah. Okay. It's on page 240.
Okay.
We're currently reviewing this, unfortunately. We didn't get to your hearing yesterday.
No, you missed the hearing, as did everyone else.
Well, I can understand. They're really
low there.
It was really kind of a short turnaround. I hate to say it, but I think it was published 5 days before the hearing or something. At least we got notice of it. So I know you just opened it, and there's plenty of time, and I'm sure there'll be a board meeting and all those good things. But we are doing a review. The Disability Policy Consortium is doing a review of this, and in doing so came across that and went, okay, now I'm getting really nervous serving on this committee or this council. We need to, up the ante here and get increasing the amount of service-enriched housing.
Okay. Given that is your direction that you want to take, do you have any recommendations for increasing the creation that we can use our $100,000 for fiscal year 2013 or 2012 towards?
I'm wondering, is it necessary? Would it be needed to have a consultant from another state help the department make their tax credit proposed language? And I know you passed it to your tax credit, but nothing was said in there about service-enriched housing. So, maybe we need to hire somebody from another state on how they've used tax credits, or that's the biggest producer of housing. I'd love to say trust fund or something like that, but there wasn't any money. Well, there was some money, but not much money was put in the trust fund. I don't know how you would use home. I'm just saying find a consultant or something that has done this in other states, assuming other states have done this. I know those are big assumptions right there, but it seems like somebody could come up with actual how we can change the QAP.
And when you... maybe to get a little bit more specific, are you how would you want to amend the QAP language? Like, what would you want that consultant to work towards?
The QAP, to me, and I think to all developers, it's all about the points. So obviously the only way to do it, in my, with the QAP, would be to do some kind of special project set aside, or special point, you know, you get 500 points, which I know legislatively you probably can't, you can't trump the points that the legislature has given, but what are some ways, because it doesn't seem like there was any effort this last time when the QAP was in process to try to come up with that, and maybe it needs to be a consultant to try to help the department figure that out. I don't know, but QAP is point driven. I mean,
right?
True.
You know, with tax credits, it's absolutely build it and they will come. I mean, I don't mean build the housing. I mean, you know, just have a piece of cheese and all these mice that do the development will follow it because they want to get a project.
Yeah.
But you know, I truly don't know how to do that. I don't do tax credits. I don't know how, you know, it's financed. I don't know how it would work, but surely some expert in tax credits could figure this out.
Okay.
I don't know. I just got to see us moving towards creating some service-enriched housing.
And, Jean, I think that you know, I'm right on the same page as you are. I think a lot of, you know, this council may receive some scrutiny and that, you know, appropriated funds go toward it and we're just kind of producing documents that have information in them.
Yeah.
And albeit the information is wonderful and you guys work so hard to make all this happen, but I think people will grow frustrated that there's actually appropriated funds given in this council when maybe those funds could go to actually putting housing on the ground or more services out there in the state of Texas that are so lacking. So I would be in full support of trying to work on, does it come down to educating the legislators that this needs to happen and this is how we can make it happen? Because I know that the minute something is put even in the QAP, that a developer could possibly go over there and just lobby, you know, to get it stripped.
Right.
And, you know, we need to be better and more proactive in our policy making. And I don't know if education is the key. I mean, you know, we're up a big beast, and that's a wealthy developer, you know, that has a lot of clout. And, you know, it's sad to me that we don't have just a set-aside, not just priority ranking and points, for people wanting to do these type of projects, because let's face it, it's never going to happen. But it would be because they're not competitive enough. I mean, why couldn't this state? I know it happens in other states where there is just a true set aside of funds that only go to projects that do this kind of development. I mean, it boggles my mind that we haven't done that here.
Yeah, no, and truthfully, there used to be a. Or maybe there still is a nonprofit set aside. I don't know. I've kind of stepped back from the QAP because it's become so wealthy developer driven. I mean, it is swung from over the last 6-7 years. But on the flip side of that page, since you're on the phone, I mean, you all are doing your plan too.
Right.
And maybe your multifamily bond, if it becomes active again or some of those others, we might try a way, and it may take a consultant. I'm not saying I have any, I mean, I wish I did have a clear idea of how to do this, but maybe a consultant could look at both funding entities and how policies could be created.
I can tell you right now, I mean, we would certainly, you know, engage in that conversation. I mean, our funds are not fully utilized in our multifamily, you know, bond program, so I mean, it's almost kind of like a first come, first serve if it underwrites.
Yeah.
But we're not in such a bind as those that are trying to receive tax credits. But yeah, I mean, I'm definitely looking, if we have to partner to make it happen, great, let's try to do it. I have no idea how to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I hear you talking about a consultant to look at policies other states, or I mean, it could be a consultant from another state coming in, or a consultant coming that is here looking at the policies of other states, particularly the housing tax credit program and multifamily bond programs, and making recommendations basically to, I'm guessing, to our boards?
Right. We set the policies. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, and truthfully, this is in tandem, obviously, with what's going on with the 811, because, well, of course, we'll all know once it comes down from the feds what it really is going to look like, but, I mean, it has potential. I mean, 25% of a development, you know, that's 50 units if you're doing a 200 development, could be 811. I mean, could be for people with disabilities, and that could have a major impact. I know you guys are looking at it from that perspective with tax credits, but my greatest fear is having the will of the board, who is going to be heavily influenced by the private developers who don't want to do this kind of development. I mean, because they can't make the money they usually make, I guess.
Right.
You know, so it falls on the large nonprofits, probably, to do, you know, some of this development. But maybe it's having capacity building, somebody to do capacity building for the nonprofits, since the for-profits won't do it. Or maybe.
That was the recommendation that I was going to bring to you both today, that I had discussed in depth with Kate Moore, was that, you know, at looking back at the research that council staff has done into the ways in which the best practice developers have created service-enriched housing in the past, you know, where they get started. And, you know, Jean, you gave me the nugget of knowledge that back in the day, Housing Trust Fund had some capacity building money to basically for your organization to hire an expert in a HUD funding source, which was Section 811, to help you with that first process of applying, getting that funding, putting it into a development, seeing that through. And so, you know, that gave me the idea of the potential use of this unbudgeted money for the council would be towards that kind of capacity building of those organizations that are interested in service-enriched housing, that already have that mission in mind, and being able to get them the resources, those experts, to move them forward, basically. Because I think that what Kate Moore has seen in working with the Mental Health Transformation Work Group, which is the TWIG, what she has seen in the policy academies that they held was that there are local communities around the state that for the first time at these policy academies were bringing together housing individuals, service individuals, and consumers in one room to say, all right, you know, you obviously thought this was a priority because you applied to be at this academy. Now you need to create a plan for your community to actually put housing on the ground. And as a result of these policy academies, we have had local communities apply for TDHCA funding for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we've seen how successful that kind of technical assistance and education can be. So I did want to put that forward, and it sounds like, Jean, that you were going to already say something of that nature.
No, I think that'd be great in tandem. But until we get some resources to develop set aside, it's capacity building's not going to, all it's going to be is frustrating, because you can't take a new community or a new person with all the capacity in the world to compete against the tax credit folks who have been doing this for years if there's not a set aside. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it would be extremely frustrating. You kind of almost have to, if you're going to do capacity building, it's going to have to be for something that is pretty sure available to help support the housing. So, I mean, I think together those things would be wonderful.
Yeah, Ashley, what kind of funding are these new entities applying for from you guys?
One was applying for tenant-based rental assistance, and one of them was applying for another home program. I believe they were applying for home buyer rehabilitation, HRA, home HRA funding.
Okay.
And this is specifically for special needs population. They were looking for that group, persons with mental illness. But obviously that was their particular focus. Another thing that I was going to say, given that Jean brought up the Section 811 funding, I hope that you all on the council realize that the reason why us and HRC went after that Section 811 funding is because we saw that it would be putting into practice, into realistic practice, what the council was created to do. Section 811 funding, in the way that it has now been created through the Melville Act, is exactly what this council, what their purpose and intent is. And so that's why we went after that funding. That and because, you know, that's what us as a state agency is looking for. We're looking to find ways to bring in more money and create more housing in Texas, but particularly for persons with disabilities connected to services. So I think that the Section 811 process, once we do get a NOFA out from HUD, will be incredibly beneficial in terms of it's going to do a couple of things. It's going to mean that we have to amend our QAP and consolidated plan. So that process will move forward in terms of the amendments of our policy documents. That process is going to move forward for Section 811, but I think that it will spark a larger discussion of ways in which we can make sure that we are providing housing for persons with disabilities in the state. And I think that what will be very beneficial is the public hearings that are required as part of that amending of the QAP and consolidated plan, because I think those public hearings, what we are going to try to very hard fight for is to have developers at those hearings, because you know you're right. There is a resistance in the private development community towards creating this type of housing, and I think we want to know exactly what their concerns are now that we have the Section 811 funding, which can be partnered with our housing tax credits. Which in itself, that is the incentive, is you get this rental assistance. So we want to know what are their continuing concerns. And I hope that through this public hearing process for 811, we will be able to hear more that will benefit the council, because the council will then, I think, be gaining more information that will help us in our policy recommendation formation for the biennial plan.
I mean, this is a silly question, but why hasn't just the department taken a stand and said, we are doing this, we are setting aside, because the developer's going to fight it no matter what, but, I mean, why can't, or is this a board thing, you know, this is where I'm ignorant to this. I mean, I just don't understand. It would be easy enough, this is me, this is my ideal, right? I mean, it's easy enough, let's just set aside some money. why can't that happen?
Right, and I understand, and it's not, I am in no way disagreeing with you in terms of that policy would get us to where we want to be. I would say that you're right. There is a board.
It's more of a board issue. Page.
Okay.
I think that we do have to overcome, you know, obstacles in terms of who has the board's ear, and maybe we have to overcome, you know, some just institutionally
right.
over time, you know, this is who has gotten our money year after year. And they're gonna kick and scream if they're less likely to get it. And so, you know, how do we overcome those obstacles?
Right.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate you guys being honest and just frank. I mean, I'm not claiming to have the answers or even, I mean, not, well, not even close to the know-how. I just, you know, I just, again, I don't know why we just don't do it. I mean, it's hard for me to wrap my hands around. I just don't, you know, my head around. I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if Mike Goodwin is, not to put words into his mouth, but I think that I've heard him say this before, that they do see in trying to deeply subsidize the rents for those who we're talking about that typically make below 30% of area median income, that they would need some type of rental subsidy component in tandem with that. In order to make it financially feasible.
And that appears to be incredibly difficult, I guess.
Apparently.
It has been so because, I mean, in terms of what I've seen in my time here is that there's not a funding source that is specifically allocated for that purpose, typically, to be used in conjunction with a capital financing source to be the rental component.
Okay.
And I think that what we, you know, part of this is maybe we have some follow-up conversations with our nonprofit developers such as New Hope Housing or Foundation Communities to ask them or to get more out of them in terms of their layering expertise, because that's what they do. They are expert layerers of funding. And that's how they make it work, is they layer and layer and layer and layer and layer. But we may get that. I mean, that's feedback that developers may give us. You know, we simply cannot make this development feasible at 30% of area median family income without a rental component.
Well, and the reality is on the for-profit side, they don't have, the nonprofit has the ability to get other sources of funding. In many cases, a for-profit group does not. Well, not from the where we would think so, foundations or cities and stuff
right.
like that. Yeah, I mean, oftentimes they have to have private equity or something of that nature. And
they take on debt, which is hard to do when you have a development of that nature.
Right, and they're not, I understand this, but it's just amazing every time, you know, there's a $100,000 developer's fee or something of that. You know, I'm going, oh, my God, they need that much money. But basically what it does is it covers all their time that they put in or you know, other expenses and stuff. But it is how they fund themselves. They're a profitable organization, you know, and this is America, after all. So we do have those profits. So.
And, you know, there are those organizations, though, that have a for-profit status but have tapped into the world of very low-income housing or housing for the elderly or persons with disabilities. I mean, I'm thinking of Diana McIver when I say this.
Right.
And so it's not impossible.
No.
That's, you know, and obviously we want to go forward saying none of this is impossible. And I guess it's the way that we frame the conversation,
mm-hmm.
our policy recommendations and our budget recommendations. So I guess it sounds like we've talked through using monies towards hiring a consultant for making recommendations to our governing board and the governing board of TSHAC regarding capital financing policy.
Right. I mean, that would be, so how do we make it attractive? I mean, and how do we set aside resources to develop? Because we've got to have the resources, so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. I will write up a blurb and have you guys look at it about that. And that will go to our next full council meeting as a recommended use of funds.
But I also think the capacity building is a wonderful idea, because that was certainly something I heard over and over again when we did the public hearings across the state.
Okay.
You know, I heard that from several different entities that are serving this demographic, but they just don't know how to have the know-how. So as Jean said, it's kind of a tandem thing.
Okay.
Maybe a step at a time. I do understand that, and there's a limited budget, but I also think that's a really good idea.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I will include that, of course. Oh, did we just get somebody else on the line?
Yeah, Mike Goodwin. Sorry, I had an unexpected meeting and just got through.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
Well, I'm alive.
There we go. And Mike, this is Elizabeth. I'm going to have to leave in just a minute. Unfortunately, I had a dental appointment, and I'm out of town by 3 o'clock. So, but I, of course, leave you in the good hands of Ashley here. So she's going to be moving on to...
Yes. We will be moving on from the budget, and Mike, I can always fill you in by email.
That's fine.
But we're going to be moving on to the discussion of our online discussion forum. I just wanted to make sure that everyone's on the same page about responding to those members of the public that provided feedback to the online discussion forum, because we left it in somewhat of an ambiguous place at the December 5th meeting, stating that obviously we wanted to tackle the issues that these members of the public brought up in our committee conference calls, but did we want to provide any type of more substantive response, I guess, to what was brought up at the online discussion forum? Or do we just say we're working on it?
How many people are you talking about?
I'm sorry?
How many people are we talking about?
Well, let's see. We received 31 responses from, I think, 12 individuals. So it's not a lot of people, but if we wanted to have something posted on our website that anyone could see.
I mean, have you already thanked them for their comments and that sort of thing?
We put up a little blurb on the forum once it had closed.
Uh-huh.
That was like, you know, thank you for your input, but we can certainly do something more.
The problem is if you answer them and start just say we consider it, but we're not going to do it, or we consider it, or we think the deeper you go, the more chance you're going to get to have somebody come back and be unhappy. But acknowledging the people that provided input and then letting them see the end product might be appropriate.
Okay. So acknowledging that their ideas are moving forward into the biennial planning process.
Yeah, they've been put into the biennial planning process, and we really appreciate their participation.
Yeah, I think that's sufficient.
Okay. I will do that. That was a quick one. Okay. So the next item was it was brought up at the last council meeting, the issue of fair housing as it's related to the council and as it's related to service-enriched housing. And it sounded like many members of the council were interested in pursuing this as a possible research topic and as a possible topic of recommendations within the 2012-2013 biennial plan. And I think that obviously the public comment we received that day mentioned a particular bill, which was HB 216 and its potential violation of the state's and federal Fair Housing Act. Was a quick analysis of that of HB 216, which I emailed out this morning to everyone, and it's not long. It's just 3 pages, but I'll give a quick rundown to maybe kickstart the discussion, and we can go from there.
Okay.
In terms of the background, for those of you who may not be familiar with HB 216, it has two main purposes. The first is that it directs HHSC to develop and publish model standards for the operation of boarding home facilities. And boarding home facilities are defined as establishments that furnish in one or more buildings lodging to 3 or more persons with disabilities or elderly persons who are unrelated to the owner, and provides a variety of services that are listed on the document, but particularly do not provide personal care services. They make the distinction in order to show that this is not the same as an assisted living facility. So that's the first
Ashley, piece.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I mean, what is a boarding house?
Well, that's it's interesting because I think most people would think of the phrase group home.
Okay.
The language that has been used by the legislature is a boarding home, but I believe it mostly applies to group homes.
Okay. Okay, because I thought, my gosh, there are boarding homes? What is this new term that I am not constantly being educated on? Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I think they actually use it to distinguish from a licensed group home.
Okay.
It's somebody just getting into it, kind of like the whole daycare homes. I mean, people do daycare at their homes. And, you know, somebody just decides to suddenly start taking in people with disabilities. You know, they decide they want to do that. And so they start a boarding care. They are very, very, very extensive in El Paso. Don't know why. That started up many years ago. But you just, in neighborhoods, you just see houses, you know, that they go, oh, that's a boarding home. You know, and individuals work at home and take care of people. But they're not licensed. They're not getting any funding from the state. They're just taking the person's check, generally, and, you know, giving them back, kind of like a nursing home. They give them back so much, and the rest they use to take care of them.
And what is the advocacy feel for these type of developments or homes?
Generally, because they're unlicensed, some are bad and some are good.
Okay.
But oftentimes that's where you see a lot of abuse.
Okay.
And a lot of emotional abuse because people are stuck. They have nowhere else to live. It's there on the street. You know, particularly these crop out also if you have somebody that has a criminal background, they can't get into anything that's subsidized or, you know, anything, many of the others that are legitimate or licensed. And so these are sort of, you know, the underground.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, and the in terms of the there was feedback that was provided by stakeholders throughout the process, starting with when it was in front of the legislature. And I will say that I did some reading into in the city of Austin, the community, the neighborhood association that was most vocal about this and was in front of the state legislature testifying. What they have claimed is that they have seen a large increase in emergency calls, so calls to our emergency services for the city that are coming from these types of facilities.
Yeah.
So that first piece was that HHSC had to develop and publish these model standards for the operation of these facilities. And then the second piece was that local counties and municipalities they're allowed to, they don't have to, but they may require boarding home facilities to obtain a permit to operate and may adopt the standards developed by HHSC. So it's on a county by county or city by city basis that they can start to do this. Now, in order to, I guess, get to the point of the representative that attended our council meeting on December 5th, he basically was upset about the wording of HB 216 because he thinks that it's in violation of the Federal Fair Housing Act, and based on his written testimony, what I tried to understand in his argument was that he thinks that HB 216 allows otherwise neutral local rules and regulations such as land use laws and health and safety laws be used in a manner that discriminates against people with disabilities because it treats them differently from other persons. Therefore, by defining a boarding home facility as specifically housing persons with disabilities in its definition, and then regulating that form of housing, it's considered differential treatment. So that was the basis for him saying that he felt like this law maybe ran aground of our state and federal fair housing legislation.
But didn't the definition include something other persons other than persons with disabilities?
That's correct. It can include the elderly as well.
Okay. And as long as the persons with disabilities are not treated any differently than the other persons eligible for that housing, by definition, it's not discrimination, other than the fact that maybe you got two protected classes.
Well, and that, you know, I think that it's an interesting argument, whether or not we agree with his argument or not. I think that what, you know, when running this by the legal teams at HHSC and at DADS, because DADS has now taken over the implementation of the boarding home model standards, they had not received any feedback of this nature. they said they had received feedback when they were going through the process of creating the model standards, but it was not related to fair housing. So I think that it's interesting that it's being brought up, but I think that it also, as we remember at the meeting, opened up a larger discussion about how do we look at service-enriched housing and potential barriers to service-enriched housing, and that fair housing discrimination is a barrier that we could possibly address in the biennial plan. So I wanted to allow us to discuss that, and perhaps discussing where further research can be done by staff, what we think the key barriers are as they relate to fair housing and service-enriched housing, and move on from there. Any thoughts?
I think we're going to beat a dead horse to death, because if you're going to go under a disparate treatment, you've got to do it from the basis of that group of persons that are making that claim are being treated differently from the other persons who are eligible for the same program. So if within the program you're treating them differently than you are someone else, then yeah, you might have one. But if everybody eligible for that program essentially is treated the same, then there's not a fair housing issue. And in fact, if you want to go further, take the 811 program for persons with chronic mental illness. It is the only program that I know of, and this certainly doesn't go to the state programs that treat mentally ill persons, but it is the only program where a private owner not only has the ability but has the requirement to inquire as to the exact nature of the disability and require proof of that exact nature before they're eligible for the program. They're not even program eligible, and that's a HUD requirement. So, and you do not do that to any disabled person applying for housing anywhere else.
Ashley, I think you did a really good job on this analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, truthfully, I mean, they may not like the answer, but the guidance from DOJ and HUD is pretty clear.
Mm-hmm. Well, and actually, the Supreme Court has decided to take up the issue next month, actually. They're going to be discussing, I don't know all this legalese off the top of my head. Discriminatory intent versus discriminatory impact,
mm-hmm.
And what that means in relation to the Fair Housing Act is actually something the Supreme Court will be starting to discuss in February. So I think that's an interesting discussion to have, particularly as TDHCA begins its process of updating its analysis of impediments to fair housing. I think that, you know, Mike, your point is well taken, and I don't disagree with you there. I guess I wanted to see if there was, in a more general, broad sense, any conversation to be had about, across the state, do we see currently in existence issues of fair housing violation for persons with disabilities and persons who are elderly, which are the two groups that we are intended to serve here on the council, that we could make recommendations about, basically. Any legislative work that has gone, that has, is now at cross purposes with service enriched housing, or just violations that that occur at the local level that, you know, we need to work on, anything like that. I wanted to just open it up to see if we wanted to research that piece further.
Oh, I think there's absolutely discrimination. I mean, we experience it a lot in our developments, and interestingly, you know, our model is to purchase condos within condo developments, and our biggest challenge has been with other condo owners saying to us, they don't want those kind of people. I mean, it's just kind of like, wow. And we've got some residents now considering a fair housing complaint against neighbors on the condo association board because they feel like they're being discriminated against. It's interesting. You know, there is a lot of discrimination. I hate to say it's still that way, but I know for disability, it's the number one fair housing complaint at the Austin Tenants Council, as far as discrimination goes.
And actually, is TDHCA, because I know, don't you have like some, I mean, Jennifer Molinari is kind of in charge of this whole fair housing thing, right?
Yeah, so she's been the one working to contract with our outside vendor that's going to be doing the analysis of impediments, as well as gathering research on issues for Texas and related to fair housing, yes.
I mean, can we use that information rather than us trying to do a whole kind of other research kind of project? Can't we take her information, and you guys are certainly going to use that for whatever need that you need it for, but we could also just support it as a council, too, whatever policy recommendations or research you do find.
Okay.
I mean, what do you guys think about that? Because I don't have the answer to this one either, and I don't know if you guys are already doing it. I don't want our council doing it as well.
Okay. And I would just ask you that we be updated.
Yeah.
And have the opportunity to somehow, I mean, be it a informal conference call or I don't know, but have some discussions to make sure the department's contractor, whoever, is really exploring the disability side of things.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what I've done for Jennifer already is given her our list of our council members and their contact information, so that way we can, when it comes time to do the public outreach component, make sure that we have some type of meeting with the council to discuss this issue. Jennifer is very much aware that the council wants to be updated on this, and I will keep you guys in the loop when that time comes. The contract was just recently awarded, recommendations will not come until after the biennial plan is due to the governor's office.
Oh, okay.
So their recommendations we would not be able to utilize, at least this time around.
Okay.
Just because they'll be in draft form, but we can certainly, maybe if they get them in draft form by that time and we're able to look at them, we can use them. It just is going to be a timing issue. I'll keep you guys informed. All right, great. Well, I guess the next item, which was the staff research assignments, I think that what I was hoping to figure out from everyone. And this can be a multiple conference call discussion. It doesn't have to be all today. But starting to create the framework and the structure of the next plan. So beginning the process of saying, you know, what are our chapters going to be about this time? Like, what are the key issues that we want to have be the headings of our plan to delve deep into? What are our priorities this time? And I think that we obviously talked about them in the budget,
mm-hmm.
and I think that that will be reiterated for sure in our policy recommendations. Are there anything besides what was discussed in the budget? And perhaps, Mike, I should fill you in. just so you know, Mike, what we discussed in the budget discussion was about hiring an outside consultant to take a look at our capital financing policies, so things like the qualified allocation plan, and using examples from other states to make recommendations to our governing board and also the TSHAC governing board for their programs as to recommended changes to those policy documents as it relates to service-enriched housing. So that was a recommendation that was made. Another recommendation that was made was to use the funding towards technical assistance provision to those organizations, probably nonprofit organizations, that are trying to get into the world of service-enriched housing. So they have the mission to do so, and then to make that a reality, going after funding and implementing that funding.
So that means I didn't get my donuts.
Donuts was not on the list, no.
Yeah, I think in the report, if we can emphasize through these initiatives how we're trying to position the state, the resources, you know, to redirect them or whatever to promote the development of service-enriched housing.
Okay, so
yeah.
How to strategically,
yeah.
Okay.
If anything else we do this year, we review. At least we know how we'd like to have it happen, you know, and whether or not it happens, I know it's all politics, but, you know, at least we know what we could do.
Right.
That would help.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you know, obviously we've been focusing a lot on TDHCA, but I know that there was focus at a previous council meeting, it may not have been the one in December, but the one before, on, and Paige mentioned this earlier, what do we do to educate and promote service-enriched housing to the legislature?
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but is that something that we want to make a priority in terms of the structure of the biennial plan? Recommendations of, you know, are along the lines of what, you know, how the legislature could be. We could do outreach, education, I don't know what, something.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if it'd be, you know, worth people's time and energy. I don't know. You know, I'd rather just us make some really solid policy recommendations.
Okay.
To them.
Okay.
You know, they for them to give consideration to.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if they need statistics to show them the dire need or what, but, you know, maybe that could be a part of that with the recommendations. I don't know. But, no, let's not go to every office and say, hey, we need to serve more people with disabilities. I mean, that's not going to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, Gene, Mike,
yeah.
What do y'all think about that?
I don't have any disagreement with that statement at all. The only thing I was wondering about, and pardon me if this was hashed out and I'm an hour behind, did anybody put a dollar figure on the recommendations for these outside consultants? And has the other committee of our council met, and how much money are they recommending we spend? Because my reading of the budget, it says there's less than $100,000 of potential disposable expense money to use for the next year.
Good question. This is the first conference call, so the Service Issues Committee conference call will take place next Wednesday. Their first one, and obviously I will be providing them the budget as well and getting their feedback on the same question about how to use the unbudgeted amount. I think that the $100,470 for fiscal year 2012, that is going to be matched by another $100,000 for fiscal year 2013, and so we can certainly put those two pots together when we're making our recommendation. Because we have the biennium to use the money, so yes, you're I think that's a good point that we are looking at roughly $200,000.
Yeah, but the issue is the budgeted and requested amounts for 12 and 13 are about $265,000 to 219. So you're already somewhere in the order of $44,000 overspent.
Well, the I believe that, I mean, and let me say that the figures, in terms of the total figures that I have received, those are from my financial services department. So I can certainly go back and make sure that I have my numbers right.
Okay, that's what concerned me is you know, instead of $100,000, you really only got 50 something. And in the world of consultants, that's not much in the way of reporting.
Well, I can certainly go back to, again, my financial administration folks who do the budgeting to make sure that I'm not wrong on my dollar amounts.
Okay.
I can say that not everything is in stone. So, you know, if we don't need $12,000 for our statewide public forums, we don't have to use $12,000. We can, you know, if we need to put, we can put more money towards, you know, if it comes out that hiring a consultant for these purposes is going to be a little bit more than we have, we can find ways of fine-tuning the other line items. These are the line items that were put into the budget by financial administration that we have to work with. So we haven't gotten into specifics of that because we haven't. This was just the first time that this idea has come forward.
No, I understand. I fully understand. That was just a note of caution. Is that
okay?
The two numbers don't agree.
Okay.
And
okay. Yeah.
Well, and ouch, Ashley, I mean, I didn't know that Suzanne had been, you know, put on another position. So how many how many PDHCA staff are now allocated to the council?
Allocated or existing?
Okay, existing right now.
Existing is me and then a portion of Elizabeth's time and salary go towards that. So me, Elizabeth.
Okay.
But it's mostly me.
Okay, because I mean that you have salaries there, which is pretty darn significant.
Right, and so that amount
very help, which is like why I don't. I mean, now that I know you're a man down, maybe there needs to be some temporary help. But you know, I'm just.
Yeah. No, I totally understand what you're saying, the amounts that are in the budget categories of this document. Are as of September 1, Suzanne was still an FTE of the councils at that time. So you're right that some of these numbers that were up to date as of September 1 do need revising. That's correct. Because of the fact that we no longer have Suzanne on board. Okay. Any other discussion about staff research assignments before we move on? Okay. Well, then, I guess what I can say is that what I'm going to try to do, besides writing up the budget recommendations that were made, is try to create some type of outline for the structure of the plan in terms of the housing issues portion of it for you guys to throw darts at. And so you know that our next committee meeting, so our committee conference call, is January 25th, so 2 weeks from today, the same time. And obviously I want to make sure that this time frame that everyone agreed to, does it still work? Are we still okay with 2 p.m. on a Wednesday?
That's for what?
For our conference calls for this committee.
So we're having two calls a month?
Right.
Okay.
So I'm sorry.
I had it on my calendar. I had it on my calendar.
On my calendar, but I thought, for sure, I must have put that on there. I'm like, we can't be having two calls a month.
Keep sorting out the wheat from the chaff. The people really want to work.
Yeah, there you go. We're going to get some movement here going.
Okay.
And, And I, you know, we can always discuss if we need to pull back some. I was going off of what we did last time. And last time it was every 2 weeks, so typically that was twice a month for each of the committees.
Okay.
And you know, usually we're only looking at an hour to an hour and a half for the calls, but if for some reason 1 week nobody can make it, it's a really crazy week, we can always cancel. I just wanted to have a structured meeting time in place going forward so that way we can have something set up.
You got it. I'm here for you.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, if there isn't anything else, it sounds like we're done for today. And again, I'll try to get that information typed up and so that you guys in draft form, so you guys can make some revisions as you see fit.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Ashley.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.